Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Welcome to DW's Africa Link program, live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe, your host.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
Coming up, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta welcomes a move to cut salaries of senior government officials and legislators ahead of crucial presidential elections.
The days of wasteful allowances and peculiar but inexplicable payments are behind us. Better and more prosperous days lie ahead.
And we've got comments on what that means on social media.
That's right. A South Sudanese military court demands the presence in the courtroom of witnesses in the rape case of five aid workers by government troops.
All eyewitnesses should come to the court and testify. Don't tell us that others will come today and others will come after a week.
And we're also live on Facebook, so if you're on Facebook, join us live on audio.
With your comments, and the place to go is DW Africa. But before all that, here's a chance to hear what's been happening around the world.
I'm Christina Kripal with the DW News. A day after Iraq claimed victory over the so-called Islamic State, IS, in the city of Mosul, the human rights organization Amnesty International said that both the IS and Iraqi forces and the US-led coalition fighting the jihadists repeatedly violated international humanitarian law and may have committed war crimes. It called the outcome of the battle in Iraq's second-largest city a civilian catastrophe. Talking to DW, Amnesty International researcher Ben Walsby explained his organization's demands.
War crimes can only be proved in a judicial setting. What the report calls for is an investigation into the possibility of war crimes by the so-called Islamic State and by the coalition and Iraqi forces as well. An independent, impartial investigation is what we would need.
The London-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said Tuesday it had information from top IS leaders confirming the death of the jihadist organization's chief, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. The US-led coalition fighting IS in Syria and Iraq said it could not confirm the report. Russia's military said in mid-June that it was seeking to verify whether it had killed the IS chief in an airstrike in Syria in May. During a visit to Doha by U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, the United States and Qatar signed an agreement today on combating terrorism and its financing. The Memorandum of Understanding is seen as a step in trying to normalize relations between Qatar and the number of Arab states led by Saudi Arabia, who recently imposed strict sanctions on the country for allegedly supporting terrorism. This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. The Turkish government on Tuesday launched a series of events to commemorate last year's failed coup attempt by a faction in the military. Since the coup, Turkey has installed a state of emergency that granted the government wide-ranging powers and pushed through a referendum expanding the authority of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. More than 50,000 people have been arrested in a crackdown on suspected political opponents, straining relations between Ankara and the European Union. Among those jailed are nearly 200 journalists. Yavuz Baydar, founder of a platform for independent Turkish journalism, told DW what it means to be a journalist in his country today.
They are feeling the pressures of censorship and self-censorship, and they always work with the sense that they can be the next target, because what happened so far is a reminder of what can happen next. This happens particularly through social media, that one receives threats, one receives exposure, and this underlying threat is there always.
Some 23 million people around the world plan to migrate to another country. The number has been rising in recent years, according to a new report by the International Organization for Migration. More than 40% among those who are ready to emigrate live in Africa, survey data collected between 2010 and 2015 shows. The world region with the highest migration potential is West Africa, followed by South Asia, North Africa, and the Middle East. For more news and information, download the DW app from the Google Play Store or from iTunes. I'm Christina Kripal.
Welcome once again to the program. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
We begin today's program in Kenya, where President Uhuru Kenyatta has welcomed a move to slash down the hefty salaries and fat bonuses awarded to senior government officials, members of parliament, and the top brass within the country's security agencies. The salary cuts, if implemented, could save Kenya approximately 74 million euros annually. Kenya's members of parliament are among some of the best paid in the world. From Nairobi, Andrew Asike sent this report.
Kenyan MPs are known to be among the highly paid in the world. In 2013, activists led the MPs' protest against what they called greedy MPs. In the new plan, they will also lose on their fat allowances, among them the special responsibility and mileage allowance. The president's salary is down to 14,000 from 16,000 US dollars, while his deputies is down to about 12,000 from 14,000. Speaking today, President Kenyatta has hailed the new move.
The days of wasteful allowances and peculiar but inexplicable payments are behind us. Better and more prosperous days lie ahead. I commend the diligence of the Commission and its chairperson, Sara Serem, and say that their report will go a long way in guiding and ensuring prudence in the way we manage public money.
Sara Serem, who heads the Salaries and Remuneration Commission, says the allowances have long been abused.
There were claims even up to Kenya shillings 2 million per month. This in itself takes care of any of those abuses. There is absolutely no reason why both the Senate and the National Assembly members should earn a salary and at the same time draw sitting allowance for the plenary sessions. Otherwise, there will be many sitting and standing and walking allowances. So this is removed.
But Kenyans are reading foul play in the decision, which comes just a month before the elections.
When they were being voted into office, they knew what sort of salary to expect. Why that now that they have been elected, they have been greedy demanding for bigger pay? The pay cut should remain like that. If they don't want, they should go home so that we vote in new people.
This is money that could be used in improving other things, creating employment, improving infrastructure, improving living standards of the basic Kenyans.
I'm even thinking what they're earning is too much, because you can imagine there's someone out there who is earning like less than 10K. I just think they're mean.
Experts say it is unlikely that politicians will oppose the move by the SRC to cut salaries just before the elections. However, the real test is after the elections, because they can easily vote to hike their salaries again.
Andrew Wasike with that report.
Right, Isaac. Fortune Ngandu here says, wish the same can be done to our lawmakers here in Zambia.
Ichekara says, wow, so far the money is channeled to the right direction, then it's great.
And Issa Abdullahi says, it's a welcome idea, even though I'm not a Kenyan, but if Nigeria would copy this, it would have saved a lot also.
Lamina Fofana, our ardent listener from Quebec, Canada, asks, is the Kenyan government really going to be saving 8 billion Kenyan shillings every year? Will this money be invested in citizens' programs to promote democracy and good governance in Kenya?
And Brett Blake, he says, I do not see why political salaries are not comparable to a school teacher. With few exceptions, politicians seldom work their way up, and the lack of experience is almost never offset by related education.
Anyway, keep the comments flowing. Turkish authorities have ordered the arrest of 105 people working in information technology on suspicion of involvement in an attempted military coup a year ago. Over the last year, there have been a large number of police operations targeting people suspected of links to the US-based Islamic cleric Fethullah Gulen, whom Ankara accuses of orchestrating the failed putsch on July 15th. Arrests didn't spare journalists either. More than 150 journalists have been arrested since then. DW spoke to Yavuz Baydar, an outspoken critic of the Turkish government and founder of a platform for independent Turkish journalism. He tells us about his fears for free speech in the country.
Well, as journalists, we are trying to do our jobs, being critical, skeptical, and also observant about the situation in Turkey and telling the story as it is. And this means that independence and freedom of any Turkish journalist, any Kurdish journalist from Turkey, is under observation, under scrutiny. And this happens particularly through the social media, that one receives threats, one receives exposure, and this underlying threat is there always. This situation is quite severe. The case of journalists in Turkey is very fierce. More than 166 actually are in prison at the moment, according to Platform for Independent Journalism. So we are feeling the heat, we are feeling the threat in general.
Yeah, those threats, the fact that so many journalists are detained in Turkey, both Turkish journalists and foreign-based journalists like the German correspondent Deniz Yücel. What effect is that having on the journalists in Turkey who are not, shall we say, yet in prison?
Well, they are feeling, as I mentioned, the pressures of censorship and self-censorship, and they always walk and work with the sense that they can be the next target.
Okay, and are there any journalists in Turkey at the moment who are still critical of the government?
Yes, there are tiny pockets of journalism. Brave colleagues, for example, in Daily Cumhuriyet or in Politica, the Kurdish newspaper, etc. And also online journalists are quite bold at the moment. But they only constitute more or less about 7 or 8% of the entire media landscape. The rest, over 90%, is under direct or indirect government control, editorially okay. speaking.
Turkish journalist Yavuz Baydar.
Ian Bailey says, I feel sorry for the hard-working, honest people of Turkey. Erdogan is slowly bringing in a totalitarian state. I saw this coming when he became prime minister. But Abdullah Zentirki disagrees and says, best leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Thanks, Crispin, for that. Now, a military court in South Sudan has demanded that witnesses in the rape case of aid workers by government troops be brought to court within 10 days if the case is to come to a conclusion. 12 South Sudanese soldiers currently stand trial for the gang rapes of 5 foreign aid workers and the murder of 1 local journalist last July when fighting broke out in the capital. If convicted, the accused could face the death sentence. From Juba, Wake Wudu sent this report.
So far, witness testimony by the hotel employees only point to charges of looting. Judge of the military court-martial, General Knight Bruni, is now warning that time is running out. Bruni says presence of the case victims before the court, which the prosecutor has failed to present for over a month, is a legal requirement.
We don't want you to tell us that you will only be presenting the doctor and the eyewitnesses is different categories. This story of categories we don't want. All eyewitnesses should come to the court and testify. Don't tell us that others will come today and others will come after a week. We want all eyewitnesses to be brought to the court. The court will then decide how many eyewitnesses to hear from them according to the time frame that can be enough.
The 12 soldiers are charged on accounts of murder, rape and looting following flare-up of fighting in the capital, Juba, last year. Although this is the sixth session of the court proceedings following its start in May this year, none of the suspects have been sentenced because the court says it is still lacking sufficient evidence. So what is delaying this verdict? Colonel Santo Domic, the SPLA acting spokesperson,
the whole process is being delayed, you know, by the prosecution, simply because in each and every session they would place a request that they need some extra time for them to get the witnesses around. Up to now, we have not yet seen the victims, but of course the prosecution has actually assured the court that the victims are going to be made available before the court in the next session.
In today's session, the prosecutor had demanded a closed session for examination of 3 of his witnesses, a request the court granted.
Wake Wudu reporting from Juba.
Right, Isaac, and there's some sad news coming from Kenya. Former cabinet minister Nicholas Biwott has passed away just a few days after the interior minister also, Ann Kayseri, also died.
Mm-hmm.
And the deputy prime minister, William Ruto, was quick to offer his condolences, tweeting, "It's devastating that the nation has lost another great hero. Former cabinet Nicholas Biwott has been a prominent politician. R.I.P. Biwott."
Also, the former president, Kenyan president Daniel Arap Moi, described him as a dedicated servant of the people and committed, you know, cabinet minister.
Right. And another tweet coming from Juma, who says, "Nicholas Biwott helped in looting this country to the core. I never speak ill of the dead. I only speak the truth. R.I.P. Biwott."
There's been a mixture of reactions on both Twitter, Facebook about the death of Nicholas Biwott. Anyway, you can still go to our page and, you know, send in your comments and read them whenever we can right here on Africa Link. And in case you're just joining us, this is DW's Africa Link program, live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Crispin Mokideo. Thanks for joining us.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, rights group Amnesty International brands the EU policy to curb migration reckless and accuses Brussels of relying on Libya to stem the migrant crisis. Take a listen.
This is a humanitarian action. If we don't pick these people up, they will die. However, they are using those boats because of the presence of the NGOs.
And today is World Population Day, and on our Facebook page, there's been a lot of discussion about this day.
Lots of comments,
and what it means for Africa.
Definitely, and I can't wait, you know, to have you on board reading some of those comments. Anyway, to Ghana first, where the German government has announced plans to support at least 20 young business owners under a startup program that will strengthen the private sector and offer employment opportunities for the youth in Ghana. Almost 60,000 students who graduate annually from Ghana's various universities and tertiary institutions are not able to find employment within the first years of their completion. Isaac Kaleji in Accra reports.
It's a busy day for the 20 young entrepreneurs. They are meeting to interact and exchange ideas about their businesses.
By Elgreen, then you are going to start to talk about impact into mentoring programs. So I'm going to show you what we have done so far.
A facilitator guides and coaches them on what to do and the challenges that lie ahead in this new venture. They were selected from 250 applicants from across West Africa who had applied to receive the two-year international mentoring program, an initiative supported by the German Federal Foreign Office and a German non-profit organization, Impact IV. I talked to the West African Regional Manager for the group, Quentin Mirelli.
We are offering them a mentoring program that is going to be spread over 8 months. And during these 8 months, entrepreneurs and the mentors, so that are very qualified from Europe and also other region, they will meet and actually help them to develop their business. So at the end, in the future, we can create bridges between Europe and Africa. But the main point, of course, is to create jobs in Ghana.
I'm Tabi Nanzala, Kenyan, but I'm loving my Ghana experience. My interest, yes, traveling.
It's not just benefiting the Ghanaians. Tabitha Nanzala is Kenyan who resides in Accra. She wants to start her own business in the West African nation. Her company, Galani, provides technology data services for farmers to improve their yields and manage their farms.
This is a very good opportunity because, one, it's bringing people of different backgrounds, different nationalities together to share the experiences. And most of the startups fail because they lack that type of mentorship. They work alone, they work in a vacuum.
Ghanaian entrepreneur Clement Matumasen left his IT job to start his own business in north of the country.
For me, I've already started seeing the importance. You know, you meet people with the mentality, you'll be able to build a network. I cannot do everything. And if I have people in different sectors who I can share ideas with, and we'll be able to guide me in the direction of their area, because every area basically affects my area, especially agriculture.
The entrepreneurs will travel to Germany later this year, where they can learn firsthand from their European mentors. The German ambassador to Ghana, Christoph Retzlaff, says the German government is supporting budding African young entrepreneurs to help the continent fix its economic challenges.
If you see that Africa has to create about 40 million jobs a year, you know, to tackle the problem of unemployment, we obviously need the private sector to create these jobs. We need a thriving, dynamic private sector. And this program is meant, as you know, to kickstart young startups. And I'm really happy and I'm proud that we were able to bring this successful program here to Ghana for the first time.
The program is also in line with Germany's new Marshall Plan for Africa, which not only aims to increase private investment, but also entrepreneurship, job creation, and employment.
Isaac Kaleji reporting from Accra.
Right, Isaac, and I just want to acknowledge those that are tuning in and listening on our Facebook Live page. I want to acknowledge Paul Gisima. He's listening and says, thanks DW Africa for giving good information. Ibrahim Danlami Badejo says he's listening live from Wari in Nigeria. And Prince Francis Scott also says, welcome, I'm watching and listening from Nigeria. George Gaucho Kaira from Zambia also tuning in live on Facebook. Keep it Africa Link.
Africa on the move.
Chad's security services are known for brutal and repressive methods to silence any opposition. That is why four local NGOs have founded the coalition Justice ou Rien, meaning justice or nothing. The main objective of the coalition is to stop the raging violence in the country and develop peaceful means of protesting against social injustice. This includes hunger strikes, peaceful demonstrations, and signing petitions. The coalition has now committed itself to the rights of students. As the coalition's spokesperson, 31-year-old Noel Ndulume, is trying to win the students into protesting peacefully. This report by Fredius Kwenum is now presented by Zipporah Nyambura.
Emotions run high at the University of Jomena. Such scenes are familiar here in Chad. It seems to be the only resort to getting grievances heard. The students are this time protesting against the cancellation of lectures, thereby clashing with the police in the streets.
We're not just students, we are also Chadians. The population should be on our side and fight with us.
Noel Dildome and his coalition, Justice or Nothing, come in such situations. They try to convince the students to use peaceful means to get their voices heard rather than violence.
We would like to assure you that you are not alone in your fight. The coalition Justice ou Rien is standing by you. During this current crisis, we have intervened several times with the government on your behalf so as to find a solution to your problems.
Noel and his fellow activists insist on peaceful demonstrations. Although not all their requests are often heard, they don't give up. The Justice ou Nothing coalition has already proven effective. In order to persuade the government to embrace dialogue with the trade union, the activists went on a 3-day hunger strike last December. They succeeded. Dialogue started right after the hunger strike.
To me, this is a place of victory. We wanted to put pressure on the government. And when the government and trade unions sit together and discourse, it's a great success. And to me, this place is like an altar of victory.
Noel and his companions want to teach the students to protest without violence. In the end, it's no surprise. Interior Ministry refuses to approve the peaceful demo. But such setbacks are no surprise for these young activists. Neither will it deter their efforts to promote peaceful means of protesting in Chad and ensuring justice for all.
That report was by Fregis Kwenum and presented by Zipporah Nyambura.
Focus Europe.
Now, rights group Amnesty International has branded the European Union policy in the Mediterranean reckless and accused Brussels of over-reliance on Libya to stem the migrant crisis. Meanwhile, Italy issued a cry for help, saying it is overwhelmed by new arrivals. Around 100,000 people have arrived there this year. Now, the Italian government, backed by the European Commission, is busy preparing measures aimed at stopping private rescue ships from bringing more people to Italian ports. The topic is being hotly debated at the EU in Brussels, as Terry Schultz reports.
There's a call from Brussels for solidarity, for other European Union governments to help their overwhelmed partner deal with the influx. European Commission Vice President Frans Timmermans says the Commission has announced an urgent new action plan designed to relieve the pressure on Rome.
Italy has shown a level of solidarity with refugees that is almost unprecedented in European history over the last couple of years. But the levels with which Italy is faced now mean that everybody needs to do their part in this across Europe.
The action plan mobilizes a bit of new money for both Italy and Libya, but is largely a demand for more diligent implementation of current efforts already underway and the ever-present hope for increased support between EU governments. One new element, however, is causing a huge stir in the rescue community and with international migration authorities. That's the Italian plan, backed by the Commission, for a set of regulations governing NGO behavior in the central Mediterranean, designed to reduce the number of people the rescuers can bring to Italy. Some of the measures Italy's expected to demand include a pledge to always keep the ship's transponders on and to submit lists of everyone working on board. Speaking at an event in Brussels detailing the central Mediterranean migration flows, the UN's special representative, Vincent Cochetel, was outraged at the targeting of those people saving lives.
If we want to talk about code of conduct, no problem, but let's have a code of conduct for everybody. When there is a call for rescue, the Rome-based maritime rescue center, you know, try to find out which are the boats in the vicinity. Quite often we see shipping companies switching off GPS system in order not to rescue people. Can we have a code of conduct also for those shipping companies? Code of conduct for NGOs, no problem, but let's have it applying for all.
Elizabeth Collette of the Migration Policy Institute says no one party can be blamed for a situation that's simply bad all the way around. At the same time, she agrees with those who say NGOs picking up migrants very close to the Libyan shore gives people more encouragement to try to make the journey, and human traffickers less motivation to give them boats that are even remotely seaworthy.
It's an extremely complex moral quandary that NGOs find themselves in. On the one hand, this is a humanitarian action. If we don't pick these people up, they will die. However, they are using those boats because of the presence of the NGOs. But having created that situation, NGOs can't just pull out.
Former Italian ambassador to NATO, Stefano Stefanini, now a fellow with the Atlantic Council, urges everyone to look at another potential consequence of unmanaged migration.
By rescuing migrants 10, 20 miles off Libya, the volume of traffic has increased. If people in Europe don't have a feeling that the national governments and the EU are doing something, are handling the problem, this will bring to power very nasty populist parties and movements.
Stefanini tells DW he hopes Italy receives more support from fellow EU governments and the EU. He notes that helping the source countries of migration must also be a top priority, so that each summer to come doesn't bring another migration crisis by a different route.
Terry Schultz with that report about how the rights group Amnesty International is at loggerheads with the EU on the issue of migrants and the Mediterranean Sea. Over to Crispin.
Isaac, guess how many people are there in the world right now?
I think they're in billions.
There are 7.5 billion people on Earth. And 150 are being added to that population every minute. So 60 seconds, there's 150 people that have been added. Yeah. Now, by 2050, Nigeria will overtake the U.S. as the third most populous nation on Earth. How concerned are they about population growth, particularly in Africa? That was a question we asked, being World Population Day today.
On our Facebook page.
Yes. And there's been a huge discussion about this.
Okay.
Just a few comments. One from Rajabu Miovela, and he begins by saying, "Concerned? I am optimistic. With population growth comes opportunity for development. Ask China and India if you doubt that."
I like the iron about that. Matthew Chebos says, "Population with empty stomach. Africa as a continent and no country in Africa needs to be overpopulated like America because Africans can't feed themselves."
Okay. D Power says, "Pressure on society will increase. Better healthcare and education urgently needed starting now."
And Christopher Malama, for him, he thinks, "We need more people in Africa. There's plenty of space."
I don't agree. I don't think that's really... Anyway, that's his opinion. Carlos Miguel de Liberto says, "There will be no Nigeria before the end of 2018. United States of Biafra loading." And I must say, Isaac, we've had so many comments from people who are agitating for the referendum.
They are connecting the Biafra referendum to each and every story.
Every story we post now is about Biafra.
Starting on Friday when we talked about the G20 summit in Hamburg. Continue.
Exactly. As one comment from Jata Lamin says, "What a serious issue. Where is Africa heading to? Some families cannot even have a regular meal a day."
Many thanks to you, Crispin. And you can continue the debate by going to our Facebook page, DW Africa. And we will always read them whenever we can right here on Africa Link. Anyway, that's all we had. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideu.
Wishing a splendid day.